This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Erin Byrd has been advocating for social justice issues since she moved to North Carolina almost 20 years ago. She helped raise the minimum wage and organize a campaign for campaign finance reform, also worked to get same-day voter registration in North Carolina. Erin grew up in a military family. Both of her parents dedicated their careers to service. And basic benefits like health care, dental insurance, those things were covered by the government. And that's when Erin realized that it was indeed possible for the government to provide for people en masse. She says the infrastructure is there, but not the will. So she's dedicated her life to political and social activism. Right now, she's working to create a cooperative grocery store in a food desert in southeast Raleigh. It's called Fertile Ground. Erin Byrd is the executive director of Blueprint NC, a network of nonprofit, nonpartisan organizations in North Carolina, as well as the board chair of Fertile Ground. Erin, welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Let's start with that store, because you know I'm on the board of the Durham Co-op Market, and I helped get that thing going with a lot of great people in this city. And so I'm very interested in this kind of thing. Tell me more about Fertile Ground.
Fertile Ground Food Cooperative is in the organizing phase, and our desire is to, what we will do is open a community-owned grocery store and gathering space in Southeast Raleigh, one, to really build the entrepreneurial spirit in our community, to have a place where we can do education, nutrition, classes, just be together, and to provide access to affordable, healthy food and create living wage jobs, ultimately, or jobs with dignity, as we would say, where folks can come to work and they're part of what they own. You know, they own this grocery store as well as the people who consume there and the people who produce the products that are sold there.
Tell us about the area now, Southeast Raleigh. We call it a food desert.
I think that's kind of tough. The language of food desert really focuses on what's lacking and not the abundance of history, the abundance of, you know, Southeast Raleigh is where Shaw University is located. Ella Baker founded SNCC in the basement of Shaw, as well as North Carolina A&T was also founded in the basement of Shaw. St. Augustine's University is also there. And the St. Augustine has the hospital there that was one of the only places that African Americans could go to get care, you know, earlier in the year, probably around the 50s and 60s, 40s, in that period. Right. And so it's just got a really rich legacy. It's got amazing, people, families, working families living there. And so we want to sort of raise up the assets of the community. It's also predominantly Black, historically Black part of Raleigh. And historically underinvested. So when you travel different areas of Raleigh, you can definitely see the difference between the number of businesses and the number of resources in that part of town relative to, say, North Raleigh or downtown Raleigh or other parts of Raleigh.
And so you mentioned the abundance and the riches and the resources that are there. Mm-hmm. One of the things at the moment that is lacking is a kind of a neighborhood grocery store. Yeah. So you talk about that you bring these two things together, because if all you wanted to do was make a grocery store happen, you could do that. And having been the founding director of a cooperative grocery store, I'll tell you, it would be easier to do it that way than to found a cooperative.
Right.
Tell me about so why cooperative? What's the point of that?
I think that we at Fertile Ground believe that cooperative is a structure that you can use to build collective, community-owned enterprises. So and cooperatives have been around since the 1700s. They have a long legacy in this country, particularly African-American Black cooperative history. And there's a book by Jessica Gordon Nimrod on the history of Black economic cooperative thought and practice. So for us, one is remembering, you know, that we can build enterprises collectively and share in the ownership and share in the work of that and then share in the benefit. I think the second thing is that cooperatives offer They have a set of principles around voluntary open membership, democratic participation, service to communities, the values of cooperative enterprises. We feel we're strongly aligned with those values. They also offer an opportunity for community members to come together and meet their own basic needs that the system itself is not providing collectively. And they, I think the power in them is that people are coming together to govern their own institutions. And we feel that that's critically important, particularly in this moment that we're in the practice of governance, not only locally to build more reflective democracy, but statewide and nationally and so on. So we feel it's a model where we're practicing working together cooperatively, collectively, that we really need in the society actually at this moment, where there's a lot of individualism and a lot of greed and these other values. We're trying to counter those values with a cooperative structure.
And a lot of things being taken away in terms of sovereignty, voting rights being taken away in this state. So you're facing that. But is that part of the obstacle, of the sense that more and more is being taken from us? And now you're talking about something that we're not familiar with. We think about if we have political power at all, it would be through the vote. What's this grocery store business, and how does that empower us as a neighborhood or as individuals within this community?
I think there's really something about building the world we want to live in. And, you know, there are, like you've already talked about, there are a lot of things being taken away, and there are a lot of challenges in this moment. And there's a lot of energy going towards resisting those forces, I guess I would say. Mm. And what we want to also do while trying to stop bad things from happening is to build the positive things that we want and to spend a lot of energy there, because that's where sort of the lasting change, I think, is going to happen. And so I would offer that, you know, what is the grocery store? What does a cooperative grocery store have to do with it? Well, one, a place for us to gather and be together and build the types of relationships that are transformative in the community. Two, to give people a sense that they actually own this. I mean, it's not like going to Food Lion or going to Kroger or Harris Teeter, where you're going and you're giving your money to a business and that money is leaving your community.
Right.
In a cooperative, in our vision, the Durham Co-op, the Renaissance Co-op, there are a number of cooperative efforts in the state right now. You know, you go to the cooperative store and that money is actually staying in your community. And I think it's important to note that, you know, as you think about just the economics of this thing, in the white community, when you spend your dollar actually stays in that community for a couple of weeks. In the black community, you know, it's like 6 seconds, because there are not a lot of places for you to spend your dollar, and then that dollar gets spent again and gets spent again in your own community. And we want to create that underground economy to make that possible.
So how do you do it? What's the organizing like? How do you bring the community along in this process?
So there's a lot of community education that has to happen, because people generally may not be familiar with the cooperative model.
Right.
That's really important. Educating people on what is a cooperative, what are the roles of membership and ownership, what is the process to developing a cooperative, and there are a number of stages. There's the organizing stage where you get together and you say, we want to do this thing, and then there's the study, which we did a lot of, you know, going to Jackson Rising or other cooperative conferences and learning about the history of cooperatives. And then there's getting folks together to talk about the vision of the co-op and to see what is it that you need, that you are missing in your community, that we think this cooperative effort should provide. So there's the listening aspect of it. And then we begin, you know, organizing, setting up bylaws and, you know, articles of incorporation and governance structures and fundraising and finance structures and work groups and so on and so forth to actually organize an infrastructure underneath the effort.
And owners are investing. Part of the way you become an owner is to make an investment.
That's right.
And build this ownership base. How's that going?
Well, we are really excited. We hit that, you know, we passed that 300 owner mark, which, you know, in the cooperative world is a major milestone.
That's great.
And so that's a huge victory for us. We still are obviously continuing to organize and recruit owners. And we just finished a really successful crowdfunding campaign that we rooted in the history of Black cooperatives in the South, and did a lot of education on different cooperative efforts. And people should know, in North Carolina, the Franklinton Center at Bricks, which is out in Whitakers, North Carolina, was one of the places where cooperatives were developed in the South. And so there's a lot of rich history even in North Carolina.
And there's a farmer's market associated with this.
That's right. And so we've also organized a farmer's market. We felt that we wanted to provide in the organizing phase, as you know, can last a period of time. We wanted to offer a direct benefit. We wanted to ensure that our members could have access to that healthy food now. Our owners could have a place to bring their goods to market, you know, and that we would have an opportunity for us to be able to work together. It's a great visibility campaign. It brings in new volunteers. It helps us recruit new owners, and we have a really good time. And that'll be from June the 2nd until July the 24th at the Vital Link, which is a historic Black institution in Southeast Raleigh, 1214 East Lenore Street. And all of that information is on our website.
And at our website as well, stateofthings.org, if you want to find out more. I'm talking to Aaron Bird right now, Executive Director of Blueprint NC, also a founding member and board chair of Fertile Ground Cooperative. It's on its way in Southeast Raleigh. Just how we're going to talk about Aaron's earlier life before Fertile Ground and what got her interested in all this stuff. And we'll do that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'm talking to Aaron Bird, an activist who lives in Raleigh, founding member and board chair of Fertile Ground, an organization working to create a cooperative grocery store in Southeast Raleigh. Aaron's been involved in other campaigns as well, helped raise the minimum wage, organized campaign finance reform, worked on getting same-day voter registration. She's busy, and her activism is rooted in her background growing up in a military family. Tell me a little bit about growing up in that family, where you were.
So I grew up in a military family. My father was in the Army. He was an officer in the Army. My mother worked for sort of social services within the military. They have the same type of services for food shelters and domestic violence victims, any type of service that the military needs, that the soldiers need. She's a strong advocate, fierce advocate for soldiers, particularly wounded warriors. And then I have two sisters that are also both in the Army. One of them just, you know, to congratulate her, she just became lieutenant colonel a couple of months ago. And then I have a sister that's also in the reserves, yeah.
And, you know, the Army, I mean, the military, shocking as it sounds, is really the epitome of socialism, right? I mean, the government
don't
provides a lot of stuff,
yeah,
right?
Don't
I mean,
tell, any, it's
a, it's don't a, tell anybody,
yeah.
Right, of course. What
yeah,
a shock.
No, I think I grew up in, my parents married and we were, I was born in Silver Spring, Maryland, and then we moved to Georgia for a period and then to Texas. And my father, we was in Texas. He was stationed to Korea, and he was there for a year. We joined him, but he was gone for a little while before. And so we lived there, and then when he came home, we ended up being stationed in Germany. And so I grew up from, say, 80 to 86, pretty formative years, you know, living in Bibisheim and in Darmstadt, Germany. We're a really close-knit, you know, family because we moved around so much. Yeah. We didn't have the experience of living with my cousins, so I wish I had her aunts and uncles, so it was just visiting during the summer. But it was a really special childhood. I was really actually able to be a child. You know, we played. I lived near the Rhine River. I could kind of walk up the street and go to a restaurant, get French fries, and then sled, you know, and play in the water. And then we lived near a German village where I could walk down the street and get ice cream. And it was safe. And, you know, it was really kind of wonderful. And I remember Germany being beautiful and green and lush. When I went back as an adult, there was litter. I was shocked. I was like, I cannot believe there's litter here. I just remember it being so pristine.
Yeah.
Castles and visiting the Black Forest. My parents did. Mm. My mother, it was really important to my mother that we did as much as possible. She felt like she didn't have necessarily all of the fun experiences when she was growing up. So she really worked hard to to provide us opportunities to travel and see the world. You know, we were all over Europe, and it was really a special time. I think back, I missed a lot of things that were happening here. There were three TV stations. You know, there wasn't a lot of access to the types of information, MTV and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I didn't grow up on that. I didn't grow up having access to that, but it was a sweet childhood.
You didn't miss anything. Okay. I'll just say I was here for that, and it could have passed by without it. I've been happy with the three stations we had when I was growing up. But tell me more about this. Noticing, because you are provided, I mean, there's subsidized, if not, you know, in some cases free, but subsidized housing, medical care, free medical care, groceries. You probably didn't notice that at first. When did you first see that, whoa, the whole world doesn't look this way?
Well, there were a couple of different moments, but one moment I had was, I remember very specifically, I wanted to go outside and play, and the military police were guarding all the apartment complexes. And as I looked out the window, I could see Germans actually singing and holding hands. They were holding hands all around this space, and they were singing songs. And I asked my mother at that point, like, what's going on? And that was the first time she said to me, well, you know, that they don't want us to be here. And I'm like, well, why? And she said, well, you'll notice there aren't German bases in America. There aren't other military bases in America. That was the kind of the beginning of like, huh, that's curious. I wonder what that is about. But I think that the thing that was really clear to me as I got older is my parents' dental care was provided, health care was provided, housing is subsidized. If you are sent to, if you are stationed and sent to go to war in a war zone, they pay for all of your housing. So there's multiple types of benefits. And of course, soldiers are sacrificing. And so that justifies, you know, the benefits that they provide. But in my mind, as I became an adult and started to watch the rest of the world, I know that the systems are in place to provide those resources to everybody. Nobody should be deciding between, do I buy my groceries or do I purchase my medicine? And our country is making a choice to not provide those services to everybody. And that was really clear for me when I got into like high school and into college, and I'm watching the rest of the world, but my own experience was very sort of sheltered and very secure in that way. And that's not to, you know, we're not trying to glorify the military as if there aren't any issues at all and there's no challenges, but I think the point that I want to make is it's about the infrastructure.
Right.
It is available. We could do this. We can do this.
Yeah. Well, and the political will. And so this gets back to not just giving stuff away to people, but where you have the political will to arrange your resources. So the Norwegians, for instance, own their own oil. They have nationalized the oil industry, and the oil has not stopped coming out of the North Sea as a result.
Right.
They've nationalized it, and they have better health care than we have, and they have better education by every metric. And go look this up yourself.
Yeah.
So, but they've made their choice.
That's
they've said, we choose to nationalize this industry as a democracy. Mm-hmm. This is a choice, and we choose to place our resources here. So these are things you can do. And it almost gets back to the cooperative. If I own it, I make the choice about
that's
where
right.
things
that's
are
That's right. I think the other really important thing to note is we're having a conversation about the commons. You know, what belongs to the people and how what belongs to the people is distributed to them in a way that improves their quality of life. These aren't resources that belong to somebody else that you're asking back. You pay taxes. You participate in this system. You know, so in that sense, these are things that belong to all of us. And so then we should be able to make decisions about how they are used equitably, and our system is not living fully into that at this moment, in my humble opinion.
So when did you decide to put your boots to the ground and get involved in changing that or making things better?
Well, when I moved to North Carolina, I was really blessed. I was given a list of names, and on that list were Democracy North Carolina, Pete McDowell was on that list, as well as Lanice Williams, may she rest in peace, who founded North Carolina Fair Share. So I was able to come here, and of course they gave me other names, and then that led to getting the opportunity to apply to become the the coalition coordinator for North Carolina Voters for Clean Elections. And once I was able to get that opportunity, it was my first full-time job. It was the first opportunity that I had to do any organizing, have conversations with people about the importance of money in politics. And I just was impassioned, really, about it being an issue that we needed to focus on and an issue that really connects a lot of different issues. Yeah.
I want to take you back half a step, though. Mm-hmm. Before you got to that point, you went to William & Mary College in Virginia.
I did.
And you majored in geology.
I started as a geology major, yeah. And to be honest, I was terrible at understanding the angles of crystals and the math. And so I ended up having to change my major to sociology. And when I did, I had enjoyed sociology classes, the study of people. It really resonated with me. And I became sort of impassioned about fighting the systems. I would say, to backtrack, that I grew up as a very angry Black child. I saw things happening that I didn't understand. I experienced things that I didn't understand. You kind of get a sense that this, you know, people are looking at me funny, or, you know, you get this sense when mm-hmm. you're growing up. And a lot of times the public education system doesn't address sort of the history of slavery or white supremacy in this country. Any of these things aren't really addressed. And so I was just really mad. And it was the introduction to sociology and starting to understand, oh, actually, it's not me. Like, there's not something wrong with me. It is this system that is wrong, you know, and the whole way that it plays out. And when I began to understand the systems and the structures, that gave me, one, it relieved me of the pain of something is wrong with Aaron, or something is wrong, you know. So that was healing in a way. And it gave me a political analysis that I really kind of still carry. So that was one of the benefits of the sociology department at William & Mary.
I'm thinking about the paradox of being, you know, a representative in some ways as a military family of the United States of America, mm-hmm. probably embodied. If your father's in the military, in the Army, he's certainly proud of his service. He's proud of his country. Mm-hmm. And he's in a place where people are telling him, we don't want you here. And so there you have a people who are acting as though this nation has some things that we want to reckon with, that we want to call you. Mm-hmm. And you're a representative of the power mm-hmm. structure, and then mm-hmm. you find yourself being victimized by it in some ways, although in different ways, as those people where
That's
we have
right.
our bases. Did that moment ever, sort of the paradox of that moment ever strike you?
I mean, I think I lived that paradox. Yeah. I would also offer, you know, that my family was about service. So even within the military system, my father was in the Knights of Columbus. My father was in the Masons, and a leader in the Masons, and has a lodge named after him in Germany. My father actually was very active on the, he actually is very active on the board of a co-op bank there in Virginia. And he led a social club. And I found that social club very interesting because they donated money to local schools and to programs. How did they raise that money? Completely self-sustaining mm-hmm. by having Friday and Saturday nights open, and they and a DJ and music and fish and all of this. And that sustained this social club. It's called the Flying 20s. It's still around for a very long time. And so I learned service. And then my mother always being, like I said, when I say fierce advocate, like It doesn't actually really describe accurately her passion for particularly for wounded warriors and anybody who has been mistreated by the Army or any other, you know, organization. And so, and she would make us volunteer every summer for hours, childcare in the library. I know how to use an ultrasound machine, like all of these kinds of things that I had to learn. My mother, she doesn't suffer fools lightly, and she made us work, you know, and she made us, really care, both of our parents, about others. So I feel like that dynamic was also in play. And then when I, you know, decided actually the military is not the path for me, this path became very real.
So tell us more about your first nonprofit job, Voters for Clean Elections, right?
Yeah.
And what year was that? When were we talking
became the director of Voters for Clean Elections in like late 1999, mm-hmm. 2000.
Yeah.
And I was the first staff person after it was founded to work full time. And at the time, we were really fighting for campaign finance reform, which is basically that elections, an option to have elections publicly funded. The person running for office can choose to sign up for a program, and then they get public resources to be able to run for office. Now, why is that important? Because the majority of money that people raise, 90% of the money that folks raise to run for office comes from 1% of the population. To get a Senate seat right now is about $198,000 that you need to raise to be competitive to win a North Carolina Senate seat.
See, it's got to be more than $198,000.
Wow, okay. I saw that, you know, I was reading because I was doing my research before I sat in front of you. And
State
so,
Senate?
North Carolina Senate.
Yeah,
and
the
it
state
was,
senate. Okay.
Yeah, state senate. State senate,
yeah,
not
senate.
Congress. No,
yeah.
No, North
it's
Carolina.
It's got to be more than that.
Right, but the question, you know, we live here, and so who can afford that?
Yeah. No.
You know, what type of people, retired or independently wealthy, those are the individuals that can afford to run. And then for everyday working people whose voices we need to reflect what our community is asking for, they can't afford it. And so the whole system, and then when you look at who is donating to campaigns, the NRA, the private prison industry, Duke Energy, you know, I can kind of go on and on. If you do that analysis, those are the individuals that are giving the money for people to run for office. So then who is benefiting?
Right.
And I was very, very passionate about money and politics issues. And
this
still
was
am.
Before Citizens United and before the radical gerrymandering
that
and voter ID, all these other repression methods.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
So again, this is a time when this is just beginning to cascade. Are there, and there are states that have made some improvements,
there
right?
There are, and we passed the Judicial Public Financing Bill that was actually to allow judges, and this is really important, who were presiding over cases and getting the majority of the money from the same lawyers that are standing in front of them. And even the judges would say, this is awesome. You know, this allows me to be, there's a word for it, it allows me to... Not to be perceived as if I'm biased, because the thing that is really important is that sort of objectivity, I guess, as a judge, you know, not to be bought and sold. And so the Judicial Public Financing Act was passed, and I left shortly after that, but it's since been repealed, right?
Yeah. No, we've lost even. You then moved to Southerners for Economic Justice. Tell us about that organization.
Southerners for Economic Justice. I was really blessed to follow the great Cynthia Brown. May she also rest in peace. She was the former executive director of SEJ. And SEJ was at that time really focused on women of color leadership and organizing and youth leadership. So we ran a program for girls, for young girls, sort of a political and leadership development program for young girls. And we organized with lots of different women from across the state and held this big Women of Color Legislative Day, which then became the People of Color Legislative Day and led into the HKLJ movement. So there was a lot of great work done at that point in my life. And I was very blessed. I worked for Sue Perry Cole, who is a major sort of force in the economic development movement and was mentored by a lot of amazing activists and organizers.
Again,
during
this
that
is
period.
well before the surge that we're seeing now.
This is 2004 to 2007.
With those young women you were working with, what was their sense of the barriers or the likelihood that this was really going to pay off? What were you facing in 2004?
I would say, so these were middle school students, mm-hmm. middle school young girls, and it was everything that we discussed about. We talked about a couple of things, life skills being one of them, how to communicate, how to manage conflict, and how to plan for the future. But then we talked about issues, and the minimum wage issues was the issue that these young ladies wanted to focus and talk about. So they did presentations, they came to lobby day, they marched, you know, they did work to raise the issue of the minimum wage. And so I feel like what they were faced with, though, is the same thing that young girls are faced with now, which is not a lot of opportunity, you know, parents working and not having wages with dignity, and just the dynamics of being in middle school at that time. And so it was very challenging. It was a charter school that we were at, and it didn't have a lot of resources. And some of those young girls I've seen since have gone on to do really great things, and some of them have still struggled. But they always tell me that they appreciated what they learned in that product. And I think that the public school system, while it does do, you know, does some basic stuff in terms of how do I live? You know, what are the skills that I need to live and think about the world? We were trying to provide that for these young ladies.
Yeah. Talking to Erin Burge, she's executive director of Blueprint NC and a founding member and board chair of Fertile Ground, a cooperative grocery store that's underway in Southeast Raleigh. We're going to talk more with Erin on the state of things in just a few moments. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, Erin Burge. She's worked on campaigns to raise the minimum wage, to reform campaign finance, and also ensure same-day voter registration. Right now, she's executive director of Blueprint NC and involved in Fertile Ground, which is an organization with a mission to bring a cooperative grocery store to Southeast Raleigh. Talk about Blueprint NC and that organization.
Oh, so Blueprint is a collaborative. It's a nonpartisan organization of about 46 partners. And we really are rooted in two operating principles, which are racial equity and collective impact, which basically means we know we need to dismantle the systems of oppression, not only in our work and in our organizations and these broader systems, but also in ourselves. And collective impact, which is this idea that only sort of together can we resolve big problems, big issues. And our partnership is focused on civic participation, so increasing the number of people who vote, who register to vote. And we do a lot of leadership development and training because we believe that we're as strong as the amazing partners that we have. So the Justice Center, Democracy North Carolina, the AIDS Action Network, the A. Philip Randolph Institute. It's a very sort of diverse partnership. Those groups are available on our website.
What about Advance NC?
Now, Advance NC is not a partner of Blueprint because it is a 501c4 organization. And I am the treasurer for Advance NC. So that's a volunteer position that I hold. And that's a Black-led C4 organization that's really invested in building the political power of African Americans in this state. So C3s and C4s have different roles, but the Advance is very focused on organizing African Americans in counties across the state to be able to participate in the leadership and governing bodies that are making decisions about their lives without their input.
What keeps you going in all of this? We said, you know, you got involved in cleaning up the electoral process and trying to take money out in the 1990s. Things have gotten worse since then. Not your fault, but
well, thanks for that.
So you don't have to blame yourself. Yeah, the minute you got involved, things got worse. But quite seriously, things have gotten nothing worse since I got on the radio. So I can take just as much blame. Mm-hmm. Tell me about this though. What keeps you going? I mean, how do you put your shoes on in the morning?
Well, I would say that for me, this work is life and death. And that I'm experiencing, and many of us are experiencing, a period of, when I say life or death, I mean they are literally gunning our folks down in the streets in their backs. And so what keeps me motivated is that this is my purpose, and that I just can't sit. I can't actually sit by and watch. You know, I actually am not unable to sit by and watch some of the things that are happening and not feel like I got to put my shoulder to this. My children are looking at me and other children are watching all of us. And I want my sons to be able to say my mother played her part. You know, she played her part. I basically feel it's like a passion because it is so wrong and intolerable, honestly. So that's, you know, that's what keeps me up is I got to do it.
Your son asked you kind of the same question,
yeah,
right?
Because
you
we were
pushing him to get more
that.
Involved, right?
Yeah, we were talking one day. We were driving in the car, and I tell this story to people because it crystallizes for me why Fertile Ground and why some of these other efforts. My son, and let me say, I have two sons, Jai Ali, who is the light, and Hassan Bird, who is like the moral compass. But Hassan's birthday is today, so I definitely want to give him a shout out. He's turning 19. He's
Happy
an Aggie,
birthday.
Aggie Pride. I'm super proud of him. We were having a conversation, and this is actually, this conversation was in 2010, you know, and we were talking because I work a lot, you know, and he's like, why are you doing this work, Mom? And I'm like, well, you know, sometimes we have victories. I named a victory in Durham as it relates to a woman, I can't remember her name now, that was assaulted by a police officer, and the police officer here was suspended. And I said, see, look, they suspended the police officer. And my son was like, well, you know, they're just going to pull somebody else over and kill somebody else. And that actually has been happening consistently since he said it. And it occurred to me that I can do lots of work to fight all of these unjust things that are happening, but ultimately I want a new world. And so to be about building that new world, I need to put my energy and my focus in building the alternative visions. And there are lots of alternative visions that people have maybe in their heart and in their spirit. You're thinking about it right now as maybe you hear my voice. Like, that's where we need to start putting energy, or else we're only going to be pushing back against them and being on what you call the defense. You know, because that's the way the system is actually designed to keep us on the defense. And so it's really important that we start to say, okay, well, what is this alternative? Well, what would a school without SROs look like? What would community without police look like? What would absolute rule that all air and all water is clean? What would it look like to live in that world? That's the world we want to be in. What do we need to do to sort of get there and put our energy there?
And that gets back to this whole question, and I think one central to the co-op, Fertile Ground and others, which is who owns this thing? And
right.
Once we own it, if we really had authority over this school, there's a way in which we could offer a safe place to learn without weapons on campus.
I think, too, I mean, one of the things that we also, that I talk about with my my partner, Bear, Kelvin Gervais, who's building actually a network of black businesses, it's the same question. You know, we have to build the economy we need. We have to build the schools we need. We have to build the food distribution systems that we need. And these things aren't going to pop up, you know, they're not going to arrive. We live in a capitalist system that benefits from our pain. And so we have to be about creating sort of these alternatives to survive, honestly. And as things continue to be more and more challenging, it'll become more and more important. Yeah.
What about how has the conversation changed? I mean, you talked about being involved in this for a long time, watching this. We say things have in some ways gotten worse, but you can see evidence of it in terms of participation, women, African American, minority candidates of all kinds becoming active and actually winning elections.
Right, exactly.
So is this the beginning of a change, or is this just a little blip?
That's a great question. I think that it's the beginning of a change. I would say that for those of us who were around in 2009, 2010, I really felt like we spent a lot of energy on advocacy but not on organizing. And those are two very different things in my mind. Organizing is where you invest in giving people the capacity to speak and fight and work for themselves and not advocate for what they want for them, right? And so I feel like this moment now, we're spending more energy and time building up folks' human capacity to be able to participate, to understand what we're really up against, and to provide the skills for effective use of time, you know, in trying to change these conditions. And so I'm hopeful, you know, I'm hopeful, and I do see a lot of great things happening amidst a number of challenges. But we know that also this is a cycle, it's a paradigm, right? It's going to swing one way and it'll swing in the other in terms of the energy, in terms of it's like a universal law. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like we need to be working very hard to be prepared for all of the opportunities that prevent to make gains for a community.
What about the institutions, though? I mean, you've worked for nonprofits. You're working for nonprofits now.
Yeah.
Cooperative, very different. I mean, that's about ownership. It's about making profits, but making sure the profits stay with the people who own it and generate it. So it's slightly different. We'll take that one out of the mix. But mostly nonprofits. Mm-hmm. That's one institution. If you take a look at what's happened in this last cycle, the Republican Party leadership did not support Donald Trump. They were taken by surprise at the party was taken over by someone else and some other power that the leadership of that party really didn't see coming. Democrats absolutely shocked and surprised and had lost control of their lost touch with their constituents. That's why they lost. So these are the two main institutions, right? The big ones, the head institutions for expression of political will and change. Do nonprofits find themselves in the same thing? Do they have to sort of restructure and retool? If what you're really getting at is empowering individuals, is that something we have to reconsider in some ways?
Well, I think that, so nonprofits, obviously nonpartisan and not engaged, you know, with the political party system, like separate from them as a whole set of organizations and institutions. I think a couple of things. One of them is that nonprofit organizations have to start to take a deep internal look at themselves. I feel like they replicate the systems that they say they're trying to change. So as an example, hierarchical leadership, a board of directors that sometimes is completely disconnected from the community that the organization says it serves. And then at times we run our nonprofit organizations with the same culture as we would run a business or some other kind of organization, which means that our staff is not honored or respected or seen as labor. We don't pay them well. We have working conditions that aren't fair and benefits. And so all of that, you know, and so you can't change the system using the master's tools. And so the question is how our organizations need to be different in spirit and in living fully into the values that we say we care about. And that is really hard work, particularly when a lot of nonprofits are in the trenches. You know, you don't have a big budget. You might have a very small staff and you're faced with really serious community issues and problems that you're trying to work on resolving. So all of that is at play.
Well, and you're playing the big game, right? You're playing because you're raising money and that can pit you against other organizations for limited resources. So you're playing the same game, right? Competition. So cooperatives do have a little different idea. We cooperate a lot. It's a fascinating thing to think. Weaver Street Market, for instance, has been a business a long time. Very helpful to us, I'm sure to you.
Yeah.
We're helping out, we meaning the Durham Co-op Market, on which I am a board member, and they're doing pretty well. It's a competitive market, but it's fascinating to see that this thing can work, cooperation and business. When you form your board, when you, for instance, let's go back to Fertile Ground, a cooperative grocery store. What are the things that you have to take into account even in forming a board? Because it's a business, but it's a community service, and it's going to also serve these other needs.
Yeah, I think one of the things is the commitment, you know, folks' actual time commitment and being clear about what it is we're getting into when you sign up for a board. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the past Fertile Ground, we've been challenged by how when we do that, because we're happy that somebody wants to help. And so I think that's one of the things to think about. Another is the skill, you know, of board members. So we have a number of organizers on our board, community organizers like me. I've never owned a business. And so we've had a huge learning curve. And so we were grateful to bring in sort of Janet, who's our project manager, who has organized cooperatives or others that who've had that experience, somebody who knows cooperative development in some form and can bring that expertise, as well as what we need right now is somebody who's run a grocery store on our board. That would be another incentive. We do have developers to support us, but that lived experience, there's no substitute for that. And then we have folks like, you know, Demetrius Hunter, who runs Grocers on Wheels, who's passionate about getting healthy food out to folks who don't have access to it, whether they're
seniors.
What is
that, Grocers on Wheels?
Grocers on Wheels is an organization in Southeast Raleigh Demetrius Hunter runs, and he does an amazing job of he comes to Durham, he goes to other communities, senior centers, hospitals, and he meets with Black farmers, takes those goods and brings them and creates a market. And that's a business that his father and his grandfather ran. So it's like 60 years of history there in Southeast
part of this
Raleigh.
Long history in
yeah, and so just, you know, so he does have that, you know, sort of that grocery experience. So it's, you want to have people who have that experience, organizing experience, business experience, finance experience, right. A lawyer, you know, so we've had to work on strengthening our board. We still have some spaces that we need to fill, some gaps that we need to fill, but I think we've come a long way.
So talk more about your sons now, 19, just turned 19 today. And 13 years old.
Yeah.
You talked about, you know, your son's skepticism at first. I'm sure you've tried to push them towards social activism or at least getting involved in stuff. How are they taking it now? How do they see you, your the kind of work you do and whether or not it fits in their lives?
That's a really great question that I'll have to ask them directly. I think that one of the things I will say is that if you have a conversation with my sons, you'll see they have an analysis of what's happening. And I would say I did, and sometimes I wonder if it was too much, I did a lot of focus on this is racism, this is capitalism, this is compound interest, like all of these things when they were actually very young. And sometimes I feel like it might have made my oldest son a little bit despondent, I guess, because you're young and you're overwhelmed with all of these things that you can't do anything about. But he has become this amazing poet, and he opened for, like I said, I think it's Vanessa Hudson from The Voice, like a couple of weeks ago in Greensboro, and he's been traveling and you know, he I'm just so proud because, again, in his poetry, you can see his understanding of the world, which means that I didn't leave him ill-equipped to deal with the racism in this country and police issues and such. I feel like that's really important that our young people know the truth, because otherwise, like me, they may think something is wrong with them, and we have to give them the tools to assess these conditions so that they can navigate them from a place of strength and broad awareness instead of a narrow or weak or actually blinded perspective. Yeah.
And he's got a voice. He's a poet, so he feels like expression is worth it.
Yeah, amen. Amen, I'm grateful.
Aaron Bird, executive director of Blueprint NC and a founding member of and board chair of Fertile Ground, a cooperative grocery store underway in Southeast Raleigh. Aaron, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for doing this work of sharing our stories. And thank you for also being a place where real news happens.
We try. And that real news can be found at our real website, our virtual website, I guess, because nothing is real anymore, stateofthings.org. Go there and you'll see more. It is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia, really.